Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight on The Big Show, director Jennifer Lynch returns to the film scene with Surveillance. Actor Ronnie Cox reflects on his deliverance. Actress Tana Frederick explores Irene in Time. And Russian action star Alexander Nevsky talks about Treasure Hunters, his new film co-starring the late David Carradine. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody. It's great to have you here, listening live or on archive. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. Welcome to the show. We have an awesome show for you tonight.
Come on, dude. Pick up your cue there.
Oh, I'm picking up my cue, baby. Our buddy Richard Klein, who's a local filmmaker, just plugged their show on Facebook. So, very nice. That's why.
I understand.
Delay. So I'm thanking him for doing that.
We're very appreciative to everyone that supports our show. This show is packed. It's almost an experiment to see how much goodness we can pack in 2 hours. We're like a goodness
factory.
Well, we've
got 2 hours of awesomeness, though. I mean, it's not. I mean, yeah,
that's right.
You can't beat this.
Yeah. So, and it is a packed show. So let's get right to it. We love our first guest. Tana Frederick is here. She is a stunning actress who is best known for her exceptional work under the direction of legendary filmmaker Henry Jaglom. Tana was here late last year, actually, to discuss one of those collaborations with Jaglom titled Hollywood Dreams, a film in which she delivered a performance that the New York Times touted as a no-boundaries performance as startling as it is touching. And now Tana is back with Mr. Jaglom for the new film Irene in Time. The film, which I believe opens up June 19th, sensitively explores the lasting connection between fathers and daughters and its effect on the daughter's relationships as she becomes an adult. And she is phenomenal in this film. It's a great film. I can't wait to talk about it with her. Here is Tana Frederick. We bring up
her
line.
Hi, Jamie and Jerry.
Hi,
hey,
welcome back.
Hey.
You guys really do have an amazing lineup today, and I just want to say thank you for letting me be the first one out of the gate to start off the show. Wow.
We had an awesome time with you the last time you were on, so it's a pleasure to have you back.
I did too, and I didn't know you, so you've seen Irene in Time.
I have seen it, yes.
Oh, wow.
And it is really phenomenal. Let me ask you about this, because we were talking last time you were here about Hollywood Dreams,
mm-hmm.
primarily, and getting to know you and your story. But when did Irene in Time come into play? Was it during the Hollywood Dreams shoot?
It was after the Hollywood Dreams shoot, and Henry wanted to show me, you know, in a different light. You know, of course, coming out with Hollywood Dreams, it was kind of a crazy first film for me as an actress to
mm-hmm.
do, because the character was so, like, you know, out there and
Betty Davis on crack.
Yeah, that was my favorite review, by the way.
Yes.
But you know, so he really wanted something that was contained and completely different, and
mm-hmm.
So that's and plus he had wanted to do a film about fathers and daughters. Henry has a gorgeous 17-year-old daughter who's becoming a well-known filmmaker like himself. Is that
mm-hmm.
is that right? Himself. Okay. Yeah. And she just received the Method Fest Award of for Best Young Filmmaker, and she's doing great. But you know, Henry wanted to explore that, and I think that's an issue that really rings true with a lot of women. And
yeah.
with all the screenings that we've had so far, it's been really fascinating to see, you know, the women come out of the film laughing and just bawling, and then, you know, saying that they're going to call their fathers right after this film, and even to watch men you know, relate to my uncle watched it when I showed it at the Iowa Film Festival, a rough screening, and he has two daughters, and he was just, you know, it's really kind of cool how it affects both men and women.
Yeah, and I think it's true of everyone. With me, I find that it's, in terms of the relationships I build, there is a big, you know, looking for mother kind of thing inherent in that.
Yeah, yeah.
For me. And so you related personally to that kind of search, somehow dealing with the relationship with the father and your other relationships you've had in your adult life?
Well, that was kind of the tough part of the film because I have an awesome relationship with my dad. I mean, mm-hmm. My mom actually had a really, she grew up with nine brothers and sisters in Iowa on a farm.
Wow.
And yeah, and so, you know, they grew up farming, and my grandfather was an alcoholic and very, you know, verbally abusive to all of them. And so my mom chose my dad with that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm just rambling off about my history, it's just because this movie kind of makes you do that.
That's
fine.
That's okay.
Sure.
Okay. So my dad is, my mom chose a great father for me. And he and I, you know, are so cool. He's just, he was out here for this surf-a-thon I did, and he's always there. He's always supportive, and he's so patient. And we go biking together, and we, you know, have gone on fishing trips together. And so I really didn't have any issues with my dad, except that maybe, you know, I hold men to a higher standard because my dad's great. You know,
yeah.
But so that was different because the girl in this film, you know, has had a lot of goes through finding out about deception, you know, on her father's behalf, and you know, trying to deal with that with her relationships with men. So that was a little bit of a stretch because I just haven't gone through any traumas with that.
Was there something that you, an idea or a kind of a key personality trait or something you latched onto to create Irene?
You know, this is kind of interesting, but you know when I don't have you ever taken any acting classes?
Yes.
Have you ever had one of those scenes where the teacher says, where you feel like you're doing nothing, and the teacher says to you, "Yeah, that was brilliant," and
right.
you're like, "Yeah, but I was just staring at a pencil the whole time," you know? I really felt, you know, versus Hollywood Dreams where it was just work, 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 work. I really felt like I was doing nothing in this and was really terrified that I would come across as being exceptionally boring in this film.
No, quite the opposite. And I love what you're saying because even you can look at someone on the screen. I think this is what made Spencer Tracy so great. You know, you can be so overly animated, but your eyes will always focus on the person that's still in the frame. There's something so fascinating and magnetic about that.
Yeah, I mean that's been a big learning experience for me because, you know, to fight the show offness of being a newer actress, you know, to just play everything down people have been saying, you know, really responding to the performance and really relating to it in a way that, you know, my character in Hollywood Dreams pushed them away. They are drawn into this character. So
yeah.
There wasn't really anything that I latched onto except that I just was feeling so awkward the entire time because I just felt like the movie was going to turn out so crappy because I just sucked.
But I do have a question, though. What was it like to work with, like, iconic veteran actors like Karen Black and David Preval? What was that like?
Well, this was my third film with Karen and my second film with David.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually really close friends with both of them.
Oh, great.
So,
okay.
Yeah, you know, Henry does that. He kind of builds he has his stock actors and
right.
He uses them very Altman-esque, you know, uses them over and over and over. So it's kind of like summer camp when you shoot a Jack film, you know. You go back and everybody shows up on set and we're all here to have fun and talk and catch up and
right.
and do good work. So it's a joy. I mean, it's an
okay.
absolute joy. And
wonderful.
They all have such people who also work on Henry's films. There's no time to have, I think, attitudes or any sort of grandiose pretenses about, you know, their status in the Hollywood mm-hmm. industry, and they all have such amazing attitudes and just are there to just let's work, let's get this done, let's mm-hmm. do, you know, let's have fun, you know, and that's great, that's really great.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Well, I loved the film, and I thought you were completely captivating in it. And
thank you.
And there are so many times in it that I felt it seemed so kind of leisurely and unforced, some of the scenes with multiple characters, and it just seemed like they were just talking to one another. And I'm wondering, was there any improvisation, or was it all scripted?
It was scripted. I think our script ended up being 101 pages. But again, what you do with Henry is you do about two takes with all of the dialogue of the scene. And then after that, he kind of just lets you go.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just got to keep working until he yells cut, you know, and you just kind of find this flow and just, and then he ends up, you know, cutting out probably, you know, 7/8 of the scene and using, mm-hmm. You know, a tiny part of it. But yeah, so there's always room for improvisation, but we did follow a script, and he, you know, he had this specific idea of where he wanted to go, the movie to go from start to finish, from the very onset of the film. You know, a lot of people, or who's one great filmmaker, I don't remember who, said, if you have the beginning of the movie and the end of the movie, you're set. You have the movie. And Henry always had the beginning of the movie and the end of the movie in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was, you know, the one thing that was kind of also very sad and, which I did use in the film is are you familiar with who Tony Franciosa was?
No, I recognize the name.
I don't know specifically.
Yeah, he's an actor from the 40s, and he's one of the most, I feel, one of the most brilliant actors. He's like Spencer Tracy. He's just incredible, and he was in A Hat Full of Rain, and he was supposed to play my father in this, and he died 3 months before the film, so we had to rework the entire film, and so... So you know that loss, the character, my character's loss, and the loss of Tony played a big part.
Yeah, yeah. When you see the movie, first of all, can you watch your own work without being wrapped up in "I remember that day" kind of thinking?
Well, yeah, because I mean, again, in Henry's films, you have to be involved with the film from start to finish, or at least I've been placed in. An interesting position that I also helped to make editorial choices on it, you know? And so I've seen the film probably like 76 times. So I'm always jealous when I hear actors who say, I don't like to watch my own work. I've never had that luxury. I have to stare at my stupid big nose like every day.
So you were actually in the editing room for the movie, you said?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
really?
I mean, at least twice a week, yeah, and yeah, and then you know all the screenings and everything. So I've removed myself from it because I have to.
You've been with it so long and through every process of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
This is something that interests me outside of Irene and Time for just a bit. You started your own film festival in Iowa, which is where you're from.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I grew up in this really small town in, well, it's not really small. It's actually one of the biggest cities in Iowa, but it's 35,000 people. And
what town is that? What?
It was, remember the Music Man?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's River City. It was originally River City, and the whole 76 trombones and music program was started there. And it's called Mason City, though, but Meredith Willson came from there, you know, and we have, like, the Meredith Willson Library and the Meredith Willson Childhood Home and the Meredith Willson, I don't know, everything is Meredith Willson. But it's a really wonderful foundation for art, and I feel like I've gathered so much from there and been so supported by that community. So 3 years ago, I started a film festival there, you know, brought out David and Karen, and this year we have Eric Roberts coming out and Randall Kleiser.
Oh, cool. Wow.
Yeah, yeah, and just had a really great response, and the community is, it's been really cool to watch for me, because you think when you come from the Midwest that you're so isolated and that you don't have, I don't know, it's almost like you think you don't have a right to make films, or you don't have
mm-hmm.
a right to be
mm-hmm.
competitive with the East or the West Coast. And we actually provided cameras for local filmmakers
mm-hmm.
and started showing their films, and it was amazing to watch all of these lawyers and doctors and people just going out and making their own films and realizing that you can be a competitive filmmaker anywhere now with the technology that we have.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, because that is always something that's been like the two coasts, and it's just everything in between doesn't matter, but that's
right.
so untrue. It's always been untrue, but I mean, Iowa is one of the most progressive states right now. If you really want to think about it, I think that argument hopefully is going to be null and void. It's what's in between that really matters.
I completely agree, but I've had to argue that point for ever since I moved out to Los Angeles.
All right, having lived out in Los Angeles myself, you know, remember, it's like with New York or it's like with D.C., people don't think there's a world outside the city limits.
No, and they think that every state that starts with a vowel is the same state.
Yeah, exactly.
That's okay. I mean, I'm not judging.
Were you a student of film growing up? Did you really take
to film? I went to University of Iowa I started theater in fourth grade and then went on to college at University of Iowa on a full theater scholarship.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But in terms of your own personal vocabulary, were you a great lover of film, a rabid film lover at all? Or?
No, actually not at all. My mom, you know, being kind of a hippie parent, she made all our food as kids from scratch, and then she let us watch a half hour of TV, I think, when we were growing up, a half hour of TV a week.
Oh.
And so, no, I never really watched films at all. And
yet you knew that around the age of 9, if I understand from our previous conversation,
uh-huh.
that you wanted to do this for a living, right?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to do theater. I knew I wanted to do theater.
Right.
And I thought I would move out to New York, and then I wanted to make money, so I moved out to Los Angeles.
Right.
Yeah.
Is shooting with Henry, because I know you've done both stage and film with Mr. Jaglom,
mm-hmm.
How close does it come to that theatrical experience? I'm wondering, you said that he let you guys loose after a couple of takes. Is there any point where those two styles of acting converge at all on his set?
You mean as far as like feeling like theater?
Yeah, because when you shoot a film, obviously you're just shooting minutes at a time, and there just doesn't seem to be as much of a continuity of.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when you come out here and you take film classes,
mm-hmm.
they tell you to be smaller, be smaller, be smaller. The camera can read everything, and you're gonna, you know, it's gonna read you as fake or too big if you don't change your style from stage to screen. The interesting thing is that hasn't. I mean, at least when I'm filming with Henry, that hasn't been the case at all. I mean, I feel exactly the same. I feel that I'm doing the exact same things as I do on the stage. And and maybe that's because Henry allows for a bolder performance. Maybe it's because he is, you know, a 1940s-ophile, you know, and he loves, you know, Betty Davis and Bogart, who started on stage, and then, you know, a lot of those actors from then who went from stage and then got into the studio system. I don't know what it is, but it's kind of exciting, because I think in a world where film is and TV is becoming so homogenized, I mean, it's not now, because I think people are starting to, again, with the technology that we have, starting to do really daring, edgy films, and
mm-hmm.
but it feels like a world that's kind of accepted a certain style as their acting style, you know, a tiny, tiny, subtle style of acting. And Henry just lets you go big. And that's freedom. I mean, it is freedom. It feels like you're doing theater. You feel very free and very open, and it's great. I mean, it's great. I'm really blessed.
Yeah, and you have several projects actually lined up.
Mm-hmm.
A couple in post-production, if I'm to believe what I'm reading here. you never know.
Right, exactly. It's all.
So tell me about some of these upcoming projects you have.
I filmed a film in August called Katie Q with a great independent film director that I've met at the Ashland Film Festival, Ron Vignoni.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny because I meet these directors and I think, well, when I met Henry, I thought he was kind of a jerk, you know, he was very abrasive. I don't know why I'm telling you guys this is totally random.
We're your therapists. Go ahead.
We're your therapists. But aren't those the best ones, the ones that are abrasive? Because they're the ones that really care in the end, aren't they?
I guess so. I mean, I remember when I met with Ron, when I first met Ron up at Ashland Film Festival, I was like, what a cocky jerk, you know, but he ended up putting me as the lead in this film, and so I don't know. Anyway, there's your randomness. So it's a great kind of sex comedy. It's a dark sex comedy about this family. I don't know how much I can say on the air, so I'm not going to do too much. But anyway,
you say whatever comes to mind. I mean.
It's a great cast. Again, Karen's in it, and she plays my mother, and Zach Norman, and Paul Sand, who did the Carol Burnett show, and he came from Second City. So, again, it's a lot of these really seasoned, amazing actors, and David Provall, and it's a fantastic cast, and it's a really dark sex comedy. So, that's
I like up. That.
Yeah.
I mean, you sold both of us within just a matter of seconds there. I mean.
Well, it's about you know, being gentle about it and careful. There's this product called Extends, and I won't go into.
Yes, it. I'm sorry, I don't know what that is.
Amy, you just never mind.
Okay, well, it's about this family that has created the opposite version of that for women called Pucker. And without going into that...
Stop it, Jamie. Stop it now.
I can't help it. I'm so sorry.
I know you can't.
So when is that coming out?
So that'll be out the spring of next year.
Okay, great.
We're going to start camping out.
And then in December, I filmed the sequel to Hollywood Dreams, which was really fun. And Noah Wiley was my co-star, and he's the most brilliant actor I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
That's Queen of the Lot, right?
Yeah, Queen of the Lot. And it was really fun, you know. It's again launching off on the whole Hollywood parody where my character Margie from Hollywood Dreams is now Maggie and she's become an action hero and she's, you know, the first shot is her under house arrest with an ankle bracelet.
And Peter Bogdanovich is in that one.
And Peter is, yeah. Peter's great. I love
him. Well, when those come out, please come back and talk to us because we love you on the show. Come back anytime.
Back. Definitely come
I
back.
I feel the love. Big hug over the phone for you guys.
Thank you so much, Tana. We enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you guys. Have a great show.
Thank you too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's Tana Frederick. The new movie is called Irene in Time. It opens June 19th. Is that Father's Day weekend?
That is Father's Day weekend, yes.
Makes sense. See, there's a thinking behind that,
Jerry. Yeah, there is. There's a very smart marketing. You actually have intelligent people behind the marketing campaign.
Yes. It's amazing how that works out.
Yes, it is.
All right, let's get to our next guest. Another great conversation coming up for you. It's been 16 years since Jennifer Lynch shook the cinematic medium with her controversial debut film, Boxing Helena. You remember Boxing Helena, right, Jerry?
Yes, I went to see it opening day with my brother. I'm not saying anything else.
Well, it's definitely a very provocative film and very challenging, and I've been really interested in watching it again. It's been so many years since I've seen it and see how my perception of it has changed over the years. But now, after a long soul-searching hiatus, she is back with her new film, Surveillance, a Kurosawa-inspired thriller starring Bill Pullman and Julia Armand and Sherry O'Terry, and just a wonderfully diverse cast in this film, and it's wonderfully rich and frightening and provocative, of course, and actually very funny at times. It's a great ride. And our home entertainment correspondent, Aaron Ata-Diaz, I feel like he should have theme music every time we say entertainment.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Like he's on location in someone's home theater.
There you go.
Doing the interview. He spoke to Jennifer about the journey from Boxing Helena to Surveillance and a whole lot more. Enjoy this, guys. It's a great conversation. Here's Jennifer Lynch.
Well, let's get started, and I guess maybe we can get some of the unpleasantness out of the way and talk real quickly about Boxing Helena, in that it's
been... Okay. All right, let's do that.
And I say that in that I honestly don't know how you are, your feelings about it are, in that I guess it's been 16 years since the film, and so... You know, what does that distance mean in when you look back at that film?
God, it means so many different things, Aaron. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a long time coming that I could look at it again and have any objectivity. The whole experience was so potent and outrageously illuminating to me. I really, when I wrote it at age 19, I didn't think anybody was going to ever see a movie. I thought I was just writing a script. So, you know, with all that came about in the making of and the trial that ensued and all of that insanity, I think that there was a sort of a craziness and insanity and a loss of objectivity that I've now regained. And I'm also, you know, instead of 19, I'm 41 now. So, I've raised a daughter and, had many other life changes take place. And I think that I'm now back on the film as being, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that I did the very best I could, having never made a film before or written a film before. Certainly be different if I did it again today. But I'm still puzzled by the enormity and the veracity of the reactions the film got. Mm-hmm. They still sort of, and it's not a negative puzzlement, but I'm still amazed that, you know, I'm not quite sure how I went wrong in telling the awkward fairy tale, but I did. And I don't know if it's in the promotion of the film or in the film itself that it's flawed.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if anybody's actually seen the film I made.
Well, I've seen it. In that intervening time with that experience, was that a contributing factor of you kind of not making a film since then? It's been almost a decade and a half between that film and Surveillance. Was that one of the reasons that it took so long for you to get back to filmmaking?
Well, I mean, I think that certainly that had something to do with it. I also think I, you know, was given the gift of distance just through life experience. I mean, I did get pregnant almost a little less than a year after Boxing Helena was released, and I realized I was going to raise that child alone. She's almost 14 now. I had three consecutive spinal surgeries and I got sober. So I had a whole bunch of living to do in the interim and was writing the whole time and producing short films. But it sort of occurred to me that when you invite someone into the world, you should make them feel welcome. And that thing is not just something you do on the side. And I not only do I not believe in it, can't afford it, you know, this whole nanny business.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, the rejection and ostracism that came with Boxing Helena certainly forced me to what I thought was a more normal life. But I'm also grateful to that supposedly normal life for
giving me the perspective it's given me now in the work I'm doing. So, and plus I have the great kid I have and the new spine and the sobriety and all that crazy stuff. So, you know, they all have something to do with each other, but I don't know that I had anything to do with it other than participating in it.
Well, it sounds like a lot of good actually came out of boxing Paulina.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't regret a single moment of it, aside from the fact that I feel sometimes I wish that the performances that are in that film could be that as the performances they are, rather than with the onslaught of craziness that came along with it, because I think that the actors did a brilliant job, and whatever negative was said about the film or me or the trial, that, you know, I still champion the performances 100%.
Right. Well, with regards to surveillance, I got to ask, is it true that originally it had zombies in it, in the original script? Is this a true?
The original script actually had witches in it.
Oh, okay.
It was originally a totally different story. And, you know, it's funny that it even be considered the same, but that comes from the telling of how it all came about, and that is that Kent Harper, who plays Jack Bennett in the film, he and I had been producing short films together for a while, and he asked me a script of his one day that was called Tres Brujas, which in translation is Three Witches, and I didn't love the script. But what I loved was the idea of, you know, a desolate highway. And it reminded me of the cross-country road trip I'd taken with my parents. And it reminded me of my daughter and the clarity of vision she has and how we forget that and we ignore our kids and how some of the scariest moments in my life have taken place in broad daylight. And, you know, that I've always wanted to make a serial killer film, but that I hadn't seen the one that would really scare me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, out of that came many conversations with Kent, and from those conversations was born Surveillance.
Mm. And in regards to the cast, you know, Ormond, Pullman, Ironside, Oteri, and just having these actors who, you know, I'm sure the average movie executive or producer or even audience member wouldn't think that some of these actors would be in the same film. What about the casting that excites you, that having these kind of different temperaments in the film?
You know, it's sort of an amazing barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
Where you show up and you would never cast the barbecue that way,
right.
But you've never been to a better one in your life. And every conversation you have is a surprise and a sort of a gift. And I think that, you know, because I'm so interested in exploring what good and bad might look like, as opposed to what we think they look like, that, you know, these people at the barbecue, so to speak, are not who we think they are. And, you know, you think the guy in the blue jeans and the T-shirt is going to be one way, and in fact, he's the opposite, and many other things on top of that. And the same with the women and the children. And I love a surprise. So what I wanted to play with was, what do we expect from people who look a certain way? What do we expect from drug addicts and FBI agents and cops and serial killers? And aren't we all innately people we live next door to? And isn't that what's both and creepy as hell about that?
Mom! Mom, I saw something.
Oh, now we're talking.
Old school.
Mom! Dad, I saw something.
Police urge all citizens of the area to keep their doors locked.
Hey, Stephanie, my name is Elizabeth. We're going to try and talk about what happened. It's going to help you feel better.
You have the eyes?
Yeah.
You going to bust me?
For now, no.
It's all right, sweetheart.
It's just a camera.
We're driving along. We stopped the stretch.
Oh, no!
Nice shot.
We stopped to help.
Ah! Shit! Fuck!
Okay, officer, it's a flat, it's off.
I hate you.
I hate
you. Man! I hate you!
Steph just got out of the car.
Girl told us, you know, about the car.
I tried to tell my parents, but the music was too loud.
Tried to tell them what?
I saw something bad.
I know what blood looks like.
You can't save her.
I know.
And then you left the scene with the couple alive and well.
Is that your statement?
And having, you know, this project's been, you know, kind of gestating for quite some time, both pre-production and then production and then now finally getting it out. And so having that process, that long process, does looking at the film even now, as opposed to even 5 years from now, are you still surprised? Do you still find surprises when you see the film?
Surprises? You know, I don't know if I find surprises as much as I find, you know, incredible memories and gifts.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, you know, there were so many happy accidents in the making of it that, you know, it's almost verbatim exactly what I wrote, but there are nuances that can only come about from being with people as creative as the cast were and crew as creative as they were. And, you know, and there we are in the middle of nowhere in Canada, in a town called Regina. And, you know, the town that rhymes with fun. And you've never heard so many vagina jokes in your life. And it's, you know, it's laughter, and it's so when I look back on it, I remember not only the story I was trying to tell, but you know, the experiences behind the story. I don't know about surprises, but I'm really proud of the film, and I'm really proud that when I look at it, that I actually had anything to do with it. So I feel pretty lucky about that.
In regards to getting the film off the ground and getting it made and finding the distributor, what did you discover going through that process again on this film versus, you know, during your Boxing Helena date? Obviously, I mean, I'm sure you knew even going in that the world of financing and distribution and acquisitions had gone through a couple of changes from 93
yeah.
to 92. And so what was that like?
You know, it's gone through some changes, but innately it's the same machine.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way that I have to stop saying in the same way that when you are young and you think of lovers and attackers as monsters because they're foreign, those lovers and attackers become your friends when you're a grown-up. I think that that's what, you know, creating something and selling a film is. And there's a kinship and a bonding and also, you know, an inevitable feud. You know, the business mind is going to hit the creative mind, and sometimes it'll go well and sometimes it won't. And no matter what changes as far as the internet and technology, it is still this process where the businessmen are going to take from someone who isn't a business person at all this creative thing, and they're going to sell it as a product. And that's a strange process that's never going to be comfortable. But I'm real proud that anybody looked at either of my films and said, I think, show this to people, and we'd like to. So I don't know, you know, I think Boxing Helena was interesting to people because of the mess that surrounded it, and because I was related to my father, and there was all that talk and brouhaha.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that Surveillance is interesting because of the film that it is, and because I've gotten older and I'm not perfect, but I'm different. And I think that's all we can expect is as they say, progress perfection.
And I wasn't going to bring it up, but since you mentioned it, that box in Helena, because I remember when that came out and I was 14, 15, and there was that brouhaha, that cachet of Jennifer Lynch, daughter of David Lynch, makes her directorial debut. And with Surveillance, do you find that seems to have lessened? And how do you feel about that, if not being kind of one of the crutches to kind of sell the film?
Well, you know, it's weird because I think it's lessened, but I also think that because my father offered up his name as executive producer in order to get the script read,
mm-hmm.
because it hadn't been paid attention to for a year and a half, and I was either wise or unwise in accepting that I will still be having that comparison made and that relationship discussed. And I will always be my father's daughter, but I will also always be my mother's daughter and my daughter's mother and, you know, my brother's sister. And so it's a less big deal now than it was then.
Mm-hmm.
I think because I'm maybe more accustomed to the comparison.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, I hope that the work stands on its own, but I don't expect that anyone will ever stop comparing Sofia Coppola to her father, nor do I ever expect anybody to stop comparing me to my father. I mean, you know, I should only aspire to be as great a filmmaker as my father is. I don't want to emulate him, but it would be nice to be as respected as he is. So, you know, I have no problem, you know, sharing a sentence with him, even if it's critical.
and to go back real quick on the changes in the machine, if you will, of getting a film made, and to kind of as a postscript to that, what are your feelings about day and date releases of theatrical DVD on demand?
You know, I mean, I think that it's the wave of the future. I'm just not as hip as my 13-year-old daughter is, you know. I think that I haven't grown accustomed to the fact that you can see a movie on your television before it's in the theater. And that doesn't make it wrong. That just makes it the way it is. You know, I also listen to the Eagles a lot more than my daughter ever would. So I think that, I have a lot to learn about how this whole new machine works. I'm not against it, but I'm not used to it.
Right.
So I think that, I hope that people will still go and celebrate what it is, sit in a room with other people in the darkness and have that voyeuristic experience of seeing a movie, because that's really hauntingly beautiful and powerful. But I also think that Surveillance is the kind of movie that people might feel more comfortable watching alone in their homes, because they won't feel so guilty about laughing about the sickeningly funny parts. And, they won't feel so self-conscious maybe about the material they're watching. Mm-hmm. So maybe that, in the end, is best case scenario for the world and particularly for this film.
Right. Well, before I let you go, I just got to ask you to follow about your follow-up film. I believe it's called
Yes.
Hiss.
Yes.
And what stage is that in, and what's that process like, and do you see a light at the end of the tunnel of when we might see it?
I do see a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm hoping to show a sneak preview in the Toronto Film Festival, which is September.
Right.
I don't know exactly what the producers are thinking as far as a release date, but I'm in post-production now. And, it's an amazing feat that Rob Kurtzman helped me create, special effects-wise. And it was 8 months shooting in India. which is a gift I wish on everyone. An incredible country with incredible people, and they make films like nobody's business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a creature feature, love story, action adventure musical. And if you're interested in seeing the promo, it's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, just look up his trailer on YouTube and you can see it.
Okay, that's Jennifer Lynch. The new film is called Surveillance. It is available now on demand, and it is in theaters June 26th.
Sweet, that was a good interview. She was very lively, very down to earth. I like that.
Yeah. Let's talk about Boxing Helena, because I don't want to be misunderstood when I opened up the interview with a brief discussion on Boxing Helena. We have several people in the chat room that actually like Boxing Helena, and I don't dislike Boxing Helena. What I admire most about Boxing Helena is its exploration, you know, the themes that it wants to delve into and explore.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very worthy exploration. I think that, and just that theme itself, it's very provocative.
Right.
I think because of the provocative nature of that, and because of the court case that surrounded it, and that whole
brouhaha. Yeah, I don't think the film ever stood a chance. I mean,
yeah, the film didn't stand a chance, and that's what I mean by having an opportunity to watch the film again years later from a different kind of perspective, because a lot of people that watched that film when it came out were watching it just to see, oh, I got to see what this is about, because
yeah.
It already had achieved a level of it was infamous in a way.
It was infamous long before it even came out because of the Kim Basinger whole thing with her, and the film just never stood a chance. I don't remember much about it. I wasn't crazy about it, but I mean, I saw it the same day, I think, as I saw California, the one with Brad Pitt and David Duchovny.
Well, that's quite a double feature.
Oh, that is a double feature. Boxing Helena first thing in the morning, you go see California at night, and the one thing you remember about California really is the trailer for Dazed and Confused, and your friend let out this belch right before the movie started.
Hey, I have the same memory of that.
I'm sure you did. But Julian Sands got all my nerves in Boxing Helena. I mean, his just character was just so annoying and so pathetic. I thought the actress, Sherilyn Finn, right? I thought,
yes.
You know, my hat's off to her for doing that. That. I don't care who you are. That's a tough performance. That's a tough performance on every level. And
Julian Sands, he had a difficult part, too.
Oh, he had a very difficult part. I mean,
because he's essentially playing a weak obsessive.
And it's a hard thing to watch. It's a hard thing to watch. I'm not making light of that. And he's coming from the Warlock movies and Arachnophobia, and he had also been in so many really high-profile art house films before that. So this was an interesting film for him.
But the thing that you walk away from with Boxing Helena, even years later, you know that Jennifer Lynch, and obviously we're crazy about her dad. We've done tributes to him, and we'd love to welcome him on the show. If that can ever possibly happen.
Yeah, I mean, this is good.
But
Dave, we want you on the show, please. We've done a tribute
Dave,
show.
Dave, I wonder if anyone calls him Dave. I've never heard his friends call him Dave.
Well, dude, I think he should come on the show. We've done all this for him. Just literally come on the show.
Yeah, because he really owes us here.
He doesn't owe us. I mean, we our first tribute show is to David Lynch.
Yeah, because we owed him. He gave us.
Let me take it one step further. Let me take one. Your favorite movie, your indoctrination to cinema, is Wild at Heart.
That is true.
Okay, so there, I rest my case.
That's why we did the tribute.
Yeah.
All right. Are you done? Are you all done?
I'm done. But I think that needed to be out there because you mentioned it, but no one has said it as forcefully as I just said it.
You were quite forceful with it. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
My feeling is it was obvious with Boxing Helena that we have someone with a real voice,
mm-hmm.
and it's a unique voice, and I'm glad that she's back in the filmmaking game,
mm-hmm.
and I look forward to all of her work, and of course her latest work is Surveillance, June 26th in theaters, and you can order it on demand right now, and her upcoming film will be Hiss, which Toronto is that?
Yeah, she said Toronto, that she was going to show it at Toronto, so good for her. I'm glad to see that she's able, you know. Because you do wonder. I mean, it's a long time in between films. And but it's good to see that she's back in surveillance. I know for a fact it's gotten a good reception because you talk to people out in the street and they've seen it and they love it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so, yeah.
All right, next interview.
Ronnie Cox,
great guy.
Baby.
Great guy, man. And what a great career, too, that this gentleman has had. His first time in front of the camera was Deliverance. And part of cinema history, part of one of the most famous scenes in history with the dueling banjos.
Yeah, that's right.
All you need to, did that help the art of banjo playing or hinder it after that movie came out?
I'm not sure, but it's an iconic moment. And I really could have talked to Mr. Cox endlessly just about John Borman, but we didn't have
yes.
the time. But and this interview is just like really surreal.
Yeah.
It's only 2 days before, if I'm not mistaken, was it 2 days before Mr. Carradine's
passing? Yeah, and of course Ronnie worked with David Carradine quite closely in Bound for Glory, which is
yeah.
an Al Ashby film, and this interview doubled as a general conversation, which you'll hear in a moment, and a tribute to Ashby, which that part of the conversation you'll hear during our tribute show later on in the month to Ashby. And we talked about Deliverance and Bound for Glory, but he's been part of so many great movies, Taps, and The Onion Field, and Beverly Hills Cop, and RoboCop, and
oh, everything.
Total Recall.
Total Recall. Mm-hmm.
Even as he says later on in this interview, it seemed like he was in every movie ever made during a certain period of time. And he has a real love for music as well. He's a great musician, and you can purchase his CDs on our home page here. If you click on the CD cover, it'll take you to Amazon where you can purchase them yourself. And you can also investigate more about his movie and music career at ronniecox.com. He has an upcoming film out this summer, the Eddie Murphy film Imagine That.
That's right, he's in that. Oh, my.
Yeah, he is. He doesn't stop working.
He's
a machine.
The hardest working man.
So enjoy it, everybody. Here is Ronnie Cox.
Well, you know, I grew up in a little town in New Mexico, and my dad played for dances and stuff like that. So I was calling square dances when I was 10 years old. And then I was in my first play when I was in the eighth grade. And being a bit of a show off, I love that the fact that I could get laughs and not get in trouble for it.
Sure. Yeah.
which I had always before. I mean, so, and then this whole idea of performing, that I was always in musical groups and things like that. When I was in high school and college, I had a rock and roll band. I was with a singing group when I was in high school, and we got noticed. But most people don't realize this, but in Portales, New Mexico, where I grew up, 19 miles north of that was Clovis, New Mexico. And in the late 50s and early 60s, Clovis, New Mexico was a hotbed of recording. Norman Petty Studios were there. That's where Buddy Holly cut Peggy Sue.
Mm-hmm.
There was a famous country artist named Charlie Phillips that cut Sugar Time there. The Fireballs and Sugar Shack, those were all cut there. And so Norman Petty saw a singing group I was with when I was in high school, and hired us to sing backup on. So I was making records when I was in high school. Now, I put myself through high school and college with a rock and roll band, and I majored in theater in college. And then during the summers, you know, I went so when I graduated from college, my wife Mary had a National Science Foundation fellowship to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and so she got her Ph.D. in chemistry there, and I went to work for Arena Stage there. And so that's where I started that was my first big professional jobs, but at the same time I was playing at a club there called the Cellar Door, which is legendary, and Mr. Henry, so I was playing folk music in those places. And so early in my career, I got my first film, Deliverance, because I could play music. And my second big film was Bound for Glory with Hal Ashby, and I got that largely because I was a musician.
Wow. So these two passions of yours, acting and music,
yeah.
They do intermingle for you. Do they do something different to you? Do they complete you in a different way somehow?
They do, and I can. I mean, I love acting, and don't get me wrong, I'm an ardent lover of the acting. But I'll tell you what, I love the music even more, and I kept trying to figure out what it was, because I certainly can't make nearly the money in music
right.
that I can in acting. But there's a thing about, as much as I love acting, no matter how you slice it, no matter what kind of acting it is, whether it's movies, television, plays, you name it, there is and must be that imaginary fourth wall between you and the audience. With music, especially the kind of music I do, because I do music where I also tell stories and connect as much as I can with the audience, there is the possibility of a profound one-on-one sharing that takes place. And that sharing I find to be an opiate that nothing else can touch.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It's very pure.
It is.
And I think with acting in film, there are all these different elements that come in, the way your performance is cut, the choices the director makes, anything that can somehow change what you think you're doing. Whereas
exactly.
when you're, yeah, yeah.
The music is your own. The music
yeah.
you feel completely in control more than you would with the role.
Of course, and not only that. I mean, I'm the one that's making all the decisions.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
big,
by
your
telling,
own boss.
Yeah, by telling this story, the way I like to do shows anyway is I like to set up songs with a story which may or may not be true, but one which leads the audience in a way that I want them to go, and then they get the payoff, or I get the payoff in the song. And so therefore I feel like I get to use all the arrows in my quiver, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. But even so, you hear from a lot of actors, and they tend to be, surprisingly so, very introverted people, particularly as adolescents and growing into adulthood. But you don't strike me as particularly introverted, the way you're describing yourself.
Not at all. I shy. I would say that in just sort of ordinary social situations, I tend to be more shy. But I know that somehow doesn't make sense when actors say that they're shy. But I've seen a number of actors that is we're okay once we're in that comfort zone that we know about, but
sure.
just in ordinary social situations, I think of myself as being a shy person, not an introvert, but a shy person.
Tell me about the Deliverance experience. Obviously, this is your first major movie, your first time on camera, if I understand correctly.
Correct, and most people don't realize, you know, this was Ned Beatty's first film too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And people, Ned and I got cast completely separate from each other. They didn't know we knew each other. And Ned and I had been best friends for 6 years before that, and had done 25 or 30 plays together. And he's still one of my closest friends in the world. So it was really serendipitous that we got to play. You know, the original concept of Deliverance was that John Borman really wanted to do that film with he really wanted to do it with all unknowns, mainly because he didn't want anyone to be safe.
That sounds like him.
Yeah, by that I meant, you know, especially in those days, if you had Robert Redford or somebody like that in the movie, you knew he was safe. He was never going to get killed.
Right.
Sure.
And so John wanted everyone to be at risk in the movie. And so actually, in terms of finding the characters, they came to New York. I was living in New York at the time, and they came to New York looking for good unknown actors, and God knows I was unknown. And I was actually the first actor they saw in New York, not because I was at the top of anyone's list, but because because I was so unknown that they asked me to come in 30 minutes before they were going to start seeing people to see if I was worth seeing. So I went in and met with Lynn Stallmaster, who was casting the picture, and he liked me, and he gave me a copy of the script to go away to a coffee shop and come back. Luckily, I'd already read the novel, long story short, John Borman liked me. I went back and saw him two or three more times. Eventually, they flew me out here to California and tested me, and then a couple of 3 weeks later, they found Ned, and then they spent another 5 or 6 weeks looking for. It's probably the first time in the history of film that the two guys below the title were actually sort of. I wouldn't say we were cast because, you know, they wouldn't make the deal until they had everybody. Mm-hmm. But they found both me and Ned early on and said that we had the roles, although they had not made the deal. We were found before John Voight and Burt Reynolds were.
Wow. Let me ask you about Borman. I would think that would be a very fortunate blessing for you just starting out in your career to be under the direction of that man. How did he direct you?
John was the most wonderful, especially for a new young actor like me. I'd never been in front of a camera before, and he almost seemed like we were free to improvise. Now, I'm not saying that John Borman wasn't in absolute strict control of the film at all times, because he was, but we spent 2 weeks basically rehearsing all these scenes sort of in free form. I mean, what we explored were the relationships of the characters and sort of what was going on. And so what happened was, out of that, and the four of us developed such a nice rapport with each other that pretty soon we, through John Borman, had the freedom to sort of go wherever we wanted to, that was still true to the script and true to the character, and not screwing up any other character.
Right.
And so we never felt stifled. I mean, if you did something that didn't work, I mean, you said something. I mean, there was never any recrimination. There was just John would say that doesn't work, and we would do it again. But you always had that freedom, and because we had that freedom, I think that there's a lot of amazing things that happen in the film.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary film.
It is.
A real curiosity of mine. Obviously, you knew the disturbing nature of the material when you read it.
Of course.
But then again, it's a bunch of guys around the same age group on a kind of like camping type set. You're spending all the time together. I would think that there would be a real camaraderie and nice atmosphere around that set as well. But when you watch the finished product, did it surprise you how effective and how frightening that movie was?
Yeah, I was. What was amazing about that? It was iconic in lots of ways, because it was the first time men had ever been put in the position that women had been put in through the years. You know, that position, the rape or whatever. You know, all of a sudden, men were having to face that. And it was a very disturbing film. If you go back and look at that film today, and it holds up fairly well today.
Yes, it does.
By today's standards, it has very little overt violence, but it is a terribly harrowing film.
Yes.
I think part of that has to do with the genius of John Borman, and serendipitously another aspect of that. I don't know if you know this or not, but Deliverance is one of the few films, I think, in history that's shot in sequence.
Huh.
I did not know that. Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, because most films are dictated by the bottom line. I mean, if you're at this location four times, then you're going to shoot all four times when you're at that location, and that's just how. And most films are that way. Well, Deliverance starts at point A and goes to point B, You're never in the same place twice.
Mm-hmm.
So there's never any reason to and also the easy rapids are at the beginning of the film. The rapids get harder and harder as you go along. There's every reason in the world to shoot this in sequence. And the other aspect of it that then pays off incredibly is that if you skin your knee or if you bump your head or scratch your face, you don't have to cover that up if you're doing because you're not doing a scene previous the next day. You can deal. You can limp if your leg hurts. For instance, I don't know if you remember, but you know at the end of the film where there's a canoe that's broken in half.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to break that in half. We did that.
Wow.
It was there for them to take.
That's amazing, and it would produce an emotional continuity, too, that I think would be very important.
It did indeed. I'll tell you another way that it sort of paid off in a way that you would never think of. Next time you watch Deliverance, the climb when John Boyd is climbing up the mountain, there is one remarkable shot where his hand is in close-up, and his hand reaches up and grabs a rock, and he sort of pulls himself up. And in that shot, his watch is there, and the face of his watch is clouded over with steam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would never, ever think to do that.
Hmm.
That was the manifestation of his having been in the water all this time, and his watch that he was wearing was that way.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it pays off in a way. I mean, it's a subliminal way. You don't really register it consciously, but unconsciously, it just lends such what's the term verisimilitude.
Sure.
To what's going on.
There's such an immediacy to that film. I mean, it's very very authentic. Let me ask you about the different kinds of roles that you've done. You've said in the past that you're just concerned with playing different characters. You want to play as many different types of people as possible. Is there something that's missing from all of these roles for you? Is there one kind of role or type of role that you've missed out on, do you think?
Not really. I just want things that challenge me and things that you know, it sounds cliched and trite, but things that speak to the human condition.
Nothing's trite about that.
But what I've found through the years is that day in and day out, the ones that are almost the most fun to play are nearly always the villains.
you have played some of the greatest villains, I'll give you that.
I liken it to painting. If you're the good guy, you get three colors, red, white, and blue.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the bad guy, you get the whole palette.
True.
That's terrific. Yeah. And you have had a great career, if not playing villains, of playing people of authority as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what's so funny nowadays as a musician when I go around, and people are so used to seeing me either as the president or the dictator of Mars or Dick Jones or the guy on Stargate, the evil senator, I've played, and I love playing those, but then to think of me with a guitar in my hand and singing folk songs, and it sometimes sort of makes their heads go funny.
But that's
Have you noticed since you've started acting, you've been in the business for a long time? Obviously, the business has gone through enormous changes since the 70s. Has that affected you as an actor at all, or is it all the same process no matter what?
Well, you know, what's funny is I've been lucky. I've had a wonderful career, and there was a time there in the mid-80s and mid-80s through the mid-90s, I was in every film made for a while. and I've been really lucky. I've had the most wonderful home life anyone could have. And acting was never the be all and end all with me. And I think that's what's made it seem. So when it's gone through these changes, I made a life decision about 6 years ago that what gave me the most enjoyment was the music. And so now I'm sort of the opposite of most actors. Most actors, you know, because it's hard to get jobs these days. I have to say it hasn't been that difficult for me to get jobs because I'm not looking.
Right.
And these days, if they want me to act in a film, they have to beg me pretty hard. And also, as a given, they have to make room for my music. I'm the opposite of most actors. Most actors who also sing, you know, have escape clauses from their singing gigs in
mm-hmm.
case they get a big movie.
Right.
I'm the opposite.
I
will not take a movie or a television show that interferes with a music gig.
Well, follow your passion. Follow your your bliss. You know, as pretentious as that sounds.
Exactly. I've turned down a couple of films, and frankly, in Hollywood, sometimes they say, what are you talking about? And finally, they said to me, well, how much are they paying you on that folk music gig? And I said, I probably got more money in my pocket than they're paying me. but that's not the point. The point
right.
is, I've been lucky. I've made enough money. I'm not rich, but I probably have enough money, if I'm prudent, that I can live out the rest of my life. And I choose to do what I choose to do now.
Yeah, do what you love. And it's great music, and you have many CDs available. And actually, if you go to ronniecox.com, you can read more about your career, both in film and in music. So tell me the genre of music that you enjoy. Would you say that it's folk-based?
Well, for want of a better title, I would call it folk, but acoustic-oriented. It's so hard. First of all, my tastes are so eclectic.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up playing Texas swing, a jazzy, bluesy kind of stuff. I like standards. Just as an overall view, acoustic oriented is about the best way I can say. I once heard a definition of folk music. Someone said, if I like it, it's folk.
Yeah, I like that definition. That's a good,
and
good
and
one.
That sort of works for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I like Western. I grew up in New Mexico, so there's a lot of the. I'm not really a country music fan, but I like the old Western, especially Western swing,
mm-hmm. sure,
and stuff like that. But there's hardly any kind of music I don't like.
And you're going to Ireland next year.
I am. I've been approached by a guy who runs these little Irish tours, and a friend of mine, John Smith, who's a wonderful singer songwriter folk artist, has been leading these. And what they do is they take at the most 15 or 20 people, and rather than go on the typical tour, big tour buses and stuff like that, we go in just little tiny coaches and stay in either bed and breakfast or small hotels, and we go around, and the emphasis is going to the little out-of-the-way pubs and hearing the true, authentic Irish musicians.
Wow.
And we do that for like 10 days. And
well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
I think it will be. I'll take 15 or 20 people with me, and I'm not going to sing every day. I'll sing maybe a song, because if I sang every day, people would be sick of me. But I'll be there, and we'll do a song or two with the Irish musicians.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
It does.
And Ronnie, you are fantastic. And please, when we have more time, please come back and talk to us. This has been a joy for us.
Yeah, please come back.
Delighted.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Okay, that's Ronnie Cox, and speaking about Deliverance and his terrific career, and what a just another one of those great character actors that we've had the pleasure to speak to. And I mean, there's nothing like those great character actors. Just this wealth of experience and all these film sets that they've been on, and it's wonderful. Are you alive, Jerry?
Yes, I am alive. I'm just saying, I'm responding to a message from someone in our chat room.
Yes. This new interactive chat room, you can send private messages. And so for all you guys listening on archive to the show, that's what you're missing. A great camaraderie here in the chat room. So what can you do? You can whisper to someone, whatever that means. You can kick someone. You can ignore someone, which I often do. And it's a great system that they got there in the chat room. And so, of course, Ronnie Cox will be back with us later on in the month for our Hal Ashby tribute, speaking about Bound for Glory. And the new movies, Jerry. What have you seen?
What new movies do you want to talk about?
What have you seen this weekend?
What haven't I seen? Let's start with that. I would suggest that everyone leave the chat room right now. If they haven't seen The Hangover, go see The Hangover. You will not see a funnier or better film recently.
All right? It does work.
Go see it. Just go see it. Leave the chat. I don't care what the fuck you're doing. Just go see it. I don't want to hear this thing. It's offensive. It's not politically correct. I don't give a shit. It's the funniest thing that you will see this year. Just go see it.
It came in first place.
Yeah,
I mean,
it didn't come in second. Actually,
second place by $200,000.
They thought that it would, because it did really well on Friday. But it is one of the funniest things I've seen this year, without a doubt, the funniest thing I've seen this year.
Yeah.
It's right up there with Pineapple Express and Old School, as far as recent comedies go. But it's an incredible film.
Yeah. And I mean, it was real close to Up. It was like $200,000. So that's a big success for Todd Phillips.
Oh, it's enormous.
I don't think he was sweating it, actually. I think he knew that he was pretty safe with it. But on the other hand, The Land of the Lost, it's been called the first bomb of the summer.
Is it really a? Well, let me ask you this though. You know, you laugh through parts of it, but you're like, you know, I gotta say, was there a high expectation for this film, in a sense, it's based on like this really schlocky but nostalgic TV show from the 70s from our childhood, more specifically my childhood. And I have to say, it is kind of faithful for the show and everything, but there's really not much to work with there. It is sort of like Journey to the Center of the Earth, geared towards the upper teens.
Right.
That's exactly right. What it is, and I think there's some funny moments, but I do think, you know, the great irony of the weekend is Todd Phillips, who gave Will Ferrell one of his first really great film role in Old School, releases this film where he's obviously given some of these guys in The Hangover some great roles to work with, and here's Will Ferrell sort of like recycling some stuff that's not so, you know, that's really just seems all warmed over. And the other thing is Danny McBride, who is very funny, and they don't really have a lot to do.
Yeah, yeah. But it's the thinking of the studio, I'm sure, that, you know, a successful TV show, it has a kitsch kind of market.
Yeah.
Might as well make a movie. I mean, it's got dinosaurs. But we're saying this, and it sounds like we're being dismissive.
No, we're not being dismissive. I mean, it is what it is. That's what I said when I walked out of the film. It is what it is. I mean, it's... You know, you go in, you get what you pay for, I think. I don't think it's this, like, you know, a lot of critics say it was unnecessary. It's, you know, what were you expecting is, I think, the first question, you know, you want to have to ask. You know, it's Will Ferrell, Danny McBride in a Land of the Lost movie
right.
That's definitely trying to, like, get a lot of laughs. I think the Matt Lauer, and it's what I was joking about when we had Brad on the show, is, yeah, it seems like Matt Lauer is the star of the movie, and he's in more than you would think.
Mm-hmm.
It's
Matt Lauer.
He's in not only the first scene, but he comes back in the end. He's mentioned throughout the film. You would think his agent probably said, "I need Matt Lauer's name mentioned like 20 or 30 times in this."
Wow.
You know, and he's mentioned a lot. I mean, he's got this like the Mike Tyson cameo almost in The Hangover in one sense.
Yeah, I mean, I feel kind of badly for Brad Silberling, but
he didn't do a bad job. I mean. It's, you know, it had the unfortunate, I guess if you wanted to compare it to last year, it's when Get Smart and The Love Guru came out.
Right.
And that was a big, and, you know, although Land of the Lost is a billion times better than The Love Guru or, you know, maybe for that matter, Get Smart, I don't think it's a horrendous film. I think people are just being too hard on it. You know, it's a movie based on a TV show.
Right.
You know,
right.
Let's just put it all in perspective, folks.
Well, the summer's going to get good for us soon because our highlight, Public Enemies, will be coming up soon,
mm-hmm.
Which I already know that'll be a highlight.
Yeah, that will definitely be.
Yeah, and then of course Inglourious Basterds. What's up next week? I don't even know.
Next week is in. We have A Way We Go. I think opens here. The new Sam Mendes film.
Right.
That looks interesting. We got the remake of The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, which I could take or leave.
It's not called The Taking or Leaving of Pelham 1-2-3.
No, I know. I realize that. Thank you, Mr. Val.
It's funny. Come on, it's a joke.
Yeah. I know. But forgive me. I'm typing in the chat room, and I'm talking to you. I have like 3,000 different things going on here. So.
I understand.
No, it's my fault. I should be better. My ADD should be much better organized.
I actually read a good review of Taking Pelham 1-2-3 from Hollywood Elsewhere. He talked about how it's infinitely superior and more exciting than the original. The original, I just watched again, saw it years ago, and I watched it again just a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
Something great about... obviously it's a mid-70s. I think it's like 74, maybe?
Yeah. It's a great film. I mean, I'm curious to see what they do.
And some great kind of New York character there. And I think when I watch Pelham 1-2-3, I put it on the roster next to a superior film, which is Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah.
And that captures that kind of New York flavor, something that Spike Lee attempted to do with Inside Man as well. I'm not precious about Pelham 1-2-3. I think that it's could be fine for an updating. The part of the mayor, for instance, is played pretty over the top and comically in the original. And I think that Gandolfini, they're obviously going for a different, more realistic tone in terms of the portrayal of the mayor there with Gandolfini. And I think that, Denzel and Travolta and Tony Scott, it's going to be visceral. It's going to be a summer ride.
Yeah, I mean, that's all it can be. I mean, I'm not really, like I said, I have no opinion one way or the other. It doesn't really, it's not like hollow ground to me.
But have you read things about this Away We Go?
I've read some pretty nasty things about it. I think it's kind of interesting, though. I'm very curious to see if Sam Mendes can, he's like one of these directors. He's a very interesting director. But as A.O. Scott commented on the Away We Go review, that he said that he doesn't think Sam Mendes understands America. I think there's a truth to that. I don't think he gets America. I think he has an outsider's perspective of America. I'm not saying he's like Lars von Trier, who's never been here and has no, is doing it all on hearsay, but I think that's an interesting observation. I'm curious to see how he handles. He has all this great source material, great screenwriters that he adapts from. And here he has Dave Eggers. So this is a very interesting combination. Sam Mendes adapting a Dave Eggers screenplay. And I find that fascinating. And it looks like it could be good. I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt.
Well, the two leads are very appealing.
Yeah, I mean...
And I'm interested in Maya Randolph.
Yeah.
I think it's snobbery in a way that Mendes has achieved this stature in his career as one of the preeminent directors. He's made some great classy films. For him to all of a sudden in midstream go to kind of like the indie route with this film, which it feels a lot looser and more independent of him.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of a critical snobbery behind that I read between the lines in some of these reviews I read of it. That's just me.
No, I don't. I think it's something he needs to do because everything he's done has been so high profile.
Yeah.
Studio oriented. I think he needs to do this. I think he could actually hit one out of the park with this if it's right,
And I don't necessarily mind the foreigner take.
No one does. Everyone's a foreigner. I mean, I think it's very interesting because at Revolutionary Road, there's something so austere
Yeah. Revolutionary Road is just so bleak. It's so unrelenting. It is the movie that married couples won't go see because they're like, if we go see this, then we will get a divorce. We will slit our wrists at the end of the day. I'm not being facetious when I say that. People really did not want to see that movie because they're like, we live that. Why do we
right.
need to see it? And, you know, I think, though, with The Way We Go, it's a fascinating idea. You have this young couple in their 30s. They don't know where they're going. Hell, these could be, as far as we know, these could be the children or grandchildren of Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio in Revolutionary Road, for all we know. So it's a fascinating story. And
there is something, you know, how do you market a Revolutionary Road? I think they marketed it right, and it did as well as it could have. I think it's a really, you and I both agree, I think it's an honest film.
Oh, it's you couldn't get more honest.
Yeah. But how do you keep people in the seats to watch 2 hours of fighting and screaming and very little euphoria?
Yeah.
You get them with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet together
yeah.
for the first time since Titanic.
If you can't get them with that, you're not going to get them. I mean, if you can't fill the seats with that couple, I don't know how you can. But that's just it. And here's my other thing. All right, it's bleak.
Yeah.
It's unrelenting. But here's the thing, because I know that and I see that a lot with my contemporaries who are married and I know a lot of people are married who are not happily married. I would rather see that honest portrayal. Yes, I would rather spend my $8 to $10, whatever the price is, you know, at the time of day, than to see some sugar-coated fairy tale
yeah.
that is about as real, you know, that's not real at all. I would still rather pay to see Revolutionary Road than the latest romantic comedy that's full of it.
Right.
I'll be very honest with you. I will much rather take The Revolutionary Road over The Ghost of Girlfriend's Past.
Well, does that make us the minority?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It does make us the minority.
Well, I hear it from my parents a lot. I hear it from my older friends. They don't want to go to the movies to think. That's always the argument. I don't go to the movies to think. as if, you know, your ears are going to start bleeding because they're giving you Celsius equations on screen.
So, let me be, and, you know, Chris would, you know, come out against this. If you're not going to go to the movies to think, all right, chances are you're not going anywhere else to think.
Right.
At work, here, let me say this. At work, you're doing something mind-numbingly dull, chances are. At, you know, TV, you know, at the end of the day, and I understand this, TV, of course you want to tune out. I understand that more than anyone else. You want to tune out or you want to veg out in front of the internet, I guess, really, or play video games. But the movies, you are going out of the house. You are leaving the house. It's all right to think.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a crime. I'm not saying, look, I want to laugh, too. I want to escape, too. But 9 times out of 10, though, I do want the challenge.
Yeah.
I do want that. I know what I'm getting into when I pay to see Revolutionary Road. It's not like, you know, and I want that. I'm paying for that.
It is something, though, because Lynch touched on this, and it is the age-old quandary between expressing yourself as an artist and then paying heed to the business side of things as well. And it just seems to be just an odd conundrum, the selling of creativity, the marketing and the mass, you know, of something pure,
right?
Yeah, you know? and the opportunity for that to suffer through corruption along the way, and that's happened time and time again with many artists. It's an age old dilemma, I guess.
Right? It is. It really is.
But somebody that hasn't suffered that yet is Michael Mann. There's a segue.
Yeah.
and he's the subject of this Wednesday show when we pay tribute to Heat. Great movie. We're going to explore it character by character, pretty much in order of the film, and general insights and thoughts on what a Titanic kind of combination of talents, Mann and De Niro and Pacino, and really
right.
they were at a point in their careers too. This was 1995, so it's just 14 years ago. point in their careers when that's kind of the last hurrah for them in terms of the action genre, I think. They're at that age, that perfect age, where they could still do that. That was their nail in that coffin. Now, they went on to do Righteous Kill, but Heat should have been. But I mean, Heat, you can't get better than Heat. We're really looking forward to exploring our love of that film on Wednesday, and then, of course, next Sunday we'll have the three moviegoers. Three moviegoers, I can't believe I just said that. we'll have myself and Jerry and Chris all together, and also we'll bring on actor Rufus Sewell. We're working on some great stuff. Summer of 1984, Buckaroo Banzai, Purple Rain. We're going to look back at that that infamous summer at the movies. And our next guest is on the phone. That summer show comes on the 17th, by the way. I left that out. Our final guest for the evening, this is exciting, and it's something new for the show. We have an action hero in our presence, Jerry.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to talking to him, and he has quite a name.
He really does. Yes. And he is known as the Schwarzenegger of Russia, Alexander Nevsky. In his new film, it's out on DVD. You can purchase it on our homepage. It's called Treasure Raiders, and it co-stars Sherilyn Fenn and David Carradine. And Mr. Nevsky, enormously successful, and it's just a matter of time before he just takes fire in the U.S. The film actually had its U.S. premiere recently at the Delray Beach International Film Festival, and Mr. Nevsky was presented with the Rising Star Award. And we are so pleased to welcome him to Movie Geeks United. Please welcome Mr. Alexander Nevsky. Mr. Nevsky, are you with us?
Hello, I'm right here.
Hi, sir. How are you? Welcome.
Thank you very much. No, I'm very well, thank you. You know, it's an honor to be on your show, so thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you
it's
so much.
It's an honor to have you.
Now tell me about your upbringing, and when did movies become a dream for you? Were they always a dream for you?
To be honest with you, no. Many years ago, you know, in Russia, I was a very skinny kid, you know, and during Soviet Union, we didn't even have bodybuilding. Bodybuilding was illegal in Russia, by the way.
Huh.
In Soviet Union. Can you imagine? It was illegal. Wow. Because of Stallone, he killed so many Russians in his films. Remember Rambo and all that stuff? So we couldn't even name it bodybuilding. It was like athletic gymnastics, something like that.
Right.
But in 1986, I watched the first film of Schwarzenegger. I watched Conan the Barbarian, and I was like, you know, 13 years old, and I was in shock because, you know, it was the first time I saw bodybuilder on the film screen. And it was Moscow Film Festival, because they never released Schwarzenegger films there officially. It was like out of competition at Moscow Film Festival. So that was, you know, my first time, you know, watching Arnold on screen, and I decided to become a bodybuilder. And movies, you know, during the 90s, after the perestroika, I became a very popular bodybuilder there. But because of the oil crises and stuff, we kind of lost movie business, because during Soviet Union, government supported Soviet cinema, and suddenly, you know, no one supported it. Yeah, so that's why basically I decided to go to America, and I went to America first time in 1999 to learn English. You know, I still have broken English, but I learned it a little bit here.
You sound great.
You're doing good. You're doing good so far. So,
thank you. You know, you just mentioned Delray Beach Film Festival. So funny thing is, there at Delray Beach, I presented my first workshop on international co-production. You know, and can you imagine me with my broken language speaking for 2 hours about secrets of international co-production? My wife was so nervous about that. But, you know, I think it went great. I didn't answer your question, right? I'm sorry.
No, you did. You did.
tell
me when you came to California from Russia in 1999, were you frightened? What was your game plan? What was your plan to get noticed?
You know, I achieved everything I could in Russia except movie business, because I published 5 best-selling books, and they sold like 500,000 copies. It was about bodybuilding and martial arts. And I had my TV show on Channel 1 Russia. And Channel 1 Russia, you know, it's like NBC, CBS, ABC all together, because about 50 million people watched my TV show every week.
Wow.
So everything
was
great.
That was Self-Made Man?
Self-Made Man, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right.
You did your homework. Thank you. You read my bio a little bit. So my point is, our film business, unfortunately, it was, you know, it was so little. When I went to America in 1999, our total box office was $2 million. Can you imagine? $2 million. It was a total box office in all of Soviet Union. But, you know, last year, in 2008, it was almost $1 billion. So now all game changed, you know. And in 2003, I produced my first film, Moscow Heat, and we decided to do it in English, not only for Russia. And it was with me, and it was with Michael York, if you remember great Michael York.
Yes,
and,
we do.
Yes.
And Adrian Paul from Highlander. I'm sure all geeks remember Adrian Paul and Highlander TV show. It was great. And this film became a theatrical success in Russia. We released it in 2004, in the end of 2004, on just less than 100 screens, but we got about $2 million in Russia only for that film out of 100 screens. And that's how we sold it to 66 countries after that, because it wasn't like your average straight-to-DVD release. It was like one of the biggest Russian action movies. And Universal released it here on DVD in 2005. And after that, everything was easier. So I decided to produce Russian answer to Fast and the Furious. I decided to produce Treasure Raiders, the film which you know, I'm very excited of. And we did it. We did it in 2006, and we finished film in 2007. And we released it in Russia last year. It was a big theatrical success in Russia last year. And, you know, Maverick Entertainment released it here on DVD on June 2nd. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just that tragedy which happened with David Carradine. It's so sad. But
tell me about now that you brought it up, can you tell me the experience of working with him?
You know, he's a legend. And I knew him, of course. We didn't have a Kung Fu TV show in Soviet Union. We didn't have it. But I knew about him because of his films with Chuck Norris, his films with Mel Gibson. And, you know, he always played bad guys, but, you know, he played them so well, it was very easy to like him.
Oh, of course.
Absolutely. And, you know, after Kill Bill, of course, he became very famous again. And he went to Russia with Harvey Weinstein for Moscow Film Festival and for the premiere of Kill Bill. And also, I represent Russia at the Hollywood Foreign Press, so I vote for the Golden Globe Awards. So, you know, I voted for him, of course, and he was nominated for the Golden Globe, and we met with him at the Golden Globe ceremony. And as soon as I presented him with an idea to join me at the, you know, Russian answer to Fast and the Furious, you know, he was very excited because, you know, he liked cars a lot, you know.
He did.
And he actually performed some of his stunts in a movie, in my movie, in Treasure Raiders, himself, because there's a lot of car chases, and he performed a couple of them himself. So, you know, it's a huge tragedy. It's, you know, I'm very, very sad about that.
And I have to add something. I'm reading one of his memoirs right now, and just reading interviews with him over the years, especially since Kill Bill. And I'm sure, as you know, you're saying about working with him on your film, he was always so enthusiastic about working.
He loved
to work. He was working on a film in Thailand when he's doing this. So this just seems so out of character, so odd. I mean, because he really enjoyed life. I mean,
absolutely.
And it's so odd. It's, you know.
And you know, I don't believe it was a suicide. I absolutely don't believe in that.
I don't either.
And in Russia, I'm sure you agree with me, because everyone who knew him, you know, knows that David was full of life. You know, he was. If you check his IMDb page, he was working all the time. He liked that, you know, and it doesn't make sense. You know?
Working with him, and you've worked with a lot of just terrific people, but when you're watching someone like a Carradine and acting across from him, what do you learn from him?
From him? You know, it's still hard, you know, for me to talk about him in a past sense, you know, but he really was very supportive, and not only regarding acting, because for me, still, films in English, it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit hard, because it's not my mother's language, and, you know, so he was very passionate. He, you know, he taught me not only how to act better in our scenes, but also he taught me the pronunciation and, you know, all that stuff, and also after the shooting, when we had dinner, or if, you know, if we went to some restaurants or nightclubs, he was so full of life. You know, he always signed autographs for people because, again, because of Kill Bill, they all knew who he was. The old new generations, I mean, all around the world, but also in Moscow, they all knew who he was. And he never said no to any fans. You know, he signed autographs, you know, he posed for pictures, even if he was tired. So he really, you know, he really teach me how to behave, you know, as a movie star, and that style, that's like old-fashioned style, that type of stuff.
Yeah. Effortless, yeah, he was effortless. Let me ask you, I want to get more into Treasure Raiders, but back to when you came to California, you studied at the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute. What did you learn from there?
You know, it was funny because, again, I went from Moscow, and I didn't have acting education in Moscow. I graduated from Moscow State University, and I had my PhD in economics there. So it was pretty far from acting. So when I went to L.A., and I decided that, you know, I have to learn. If I want to act in movies, I have to learn. So I went to Lee Strasberg Theater Institute. And if you know Lee Strasberg personally, many, many years ago, he went to Moscow, like during the 30s, and he learned from Stanislavski personally, you know, and after that, he went back to America. He opened up two schools in New York and L.A. and, you know, created his method based on Stanislavski system. So that, you know, great ladies there at the Strasberg Theater Institute, they asked me, hey, Alexander, why did you come here? You know, why didn't you study acting in your country, in Moscow? You know, maybe in Stanislavski Institute or something. You know, I just told them that, you know, I couldn't. I had to study economy there. So I learned a lot there. You know, I studied not for 10 years. I studied just for 1 year, but it was enough for films which I'm making right now. It was enough. And of course, most important thing was relaxation. You know, to learn relaxation. You know, that was most important and entertaining thing.
Yeah, yeah. And you worked with Walter Hill early on in Undisputed. What was that experience like for you?
That was my very, very first film in America. And I was so lucky because I like Walter's films. You know, I like Red Heat, Steve Arnold, right? Remember Red Heat? I think that was the only film where Hollywood portrayed Russian as a hero because Arnold played Russian hero.
Right, yeah.
Absolutely. And it was the only film where Russian and American together fight against evil, you know, not against each other.
Right.
You know? So I like his films a lot. 48 Hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny Handsome with Mickey Rourke, all that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first film. I have very small part in this film, and Undisputed, but I got my Screen Actors Guild card, and also, you know, Walter, you know, he kind of showed me how, you know, how to work on camera, and we shot it in Nevada. And I was so excited. It was like 2001. I was so excited because it was my first trip to Vegas. But can you imagine, they met me at the airport in Vegas, and after that, they drove me outside of Vegas because Walter shot that film in some prison. It's small town, Jeans.
Mm-hmm.
It's outside of Vegas. I think there's only prison there and casino. So we lived in casino and hotel, and we shot that movie in prison. But still, it was a great experience. A good one.
Yeah, I bet. You know, you're unique in that you also write and you produce. And I'm wondering, where does that come in for you? When did you start writing? Was it always a goal to write for you?
No. But the thing is, when I came to Hollywood and, you know, when I finished my education at Lee Strasberg, when I started to go to auditions, when I started to get some offers, they offered me to play bad Russians all the time. And you know how they portrayed Russians in Hollywood films, right? It's always big, bad, stupid guys, you know. And it's not because they want to offend Russia. It's just another stereotype, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So even Jean-Claude Van Damme, who is like, you know, one of my heroes, you know, he wanted to help me. He wanted to help me because he was on the cover of one of my books about kickboxing, which I published in Russia. And when I was introduced to him by Jack Gilardi, his agent at ICM, Jean-Claude offered me a part, little part in his film, The Order, which he did with Charlton Heston, if you remember. Very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was last Charlton Heston film. So he offered me a part, and he told me, hey, just do this movie with me. You will get your sub card right away. You know, you will get an agent right away. Everything will be perfect. When I read the script, you know, of course it was like bad Russian guy who, you know, who had a fight scene with Jean-Claude's character. And again, he wanted to help me. I couldn't tell him, like, no, Jean-Claude, I don't want to play bad Russians. I don't want to betray my audience in Russia. I couldn't say things like that. I just told them that I couldn't, you know, break my education at the UCLA. But I didn't act in this film. And also I was offered the part from Columbia TriStar TV show Battle Dome. If you remember that TV show, it was kind of like cheesy version of American Gladiators. It was on UPN channel like for a couple of years. Same thing. They wanted me to play big, bad Russian.
Right.
And let me tell you, again, with all due respect, I have a huge audience in Russia, and I came to Hollywood not for that. I didn't want to betray my audience, you know. So that's why I decided that, you know, I have to produce myself. I have to do it myself. And again, situation in Russia changed in 2003 when I came back and when I started Moscow Hit. But, you know, what I found out in Russia, they start, you know, is an answer to that Hollywood films. They started to do Russian films with, you know, with American bad guys. And I didn't like it either, because I like America a lot, and I think it's a great country. I'm still a Russian citizen, but I have a green card here in California, and I like Americans. And also, I like Hollywood films. I just think we all should produce more films about friendship, you know? So in all my films, I don't know if you watch Treasure Raiders, but for example, in Treasure Raiders, there's an American and Russian, again, who fight against evil together, not against each other, together. And I think that's the point. That's why I started producing. That's why I wanted to continue with that. And let me tell you another thing. Let me use Movie Geeks United to thank all geeks, you know, for supporting my next project, Hercules the Beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, so many geeks wrote about that on the Internet when Hollywood Reporter announced it, my next project. So I want to continue with that. I want to continue producing. Mm-hmm.
We're the home of all geeks here. We're about as geeky as it gets.
we're the center, the nucleus of everything right there.
Of geeks, yeah.
That's why it's so great for me to be here, because let me put it that way. I'm the biggest and most muscular geek from Russia. I'm a huge fan of movies, huge fan of comics. So, you know, I feel like in home here. Thank you.
Oh, terrific, terrific. And so tell me about Treasure Raiders. It came out, it's available now, and our listeners can purchase it on our homepage here. Tell me about the plot behind this one, the story of this one.
So I play a Russian street racer. It's like Russian answer to Vin Diesel / Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Steven Brand, the great guy who played in Scorpion King with The Rock, he's playing an American professor, and he's teaching history in Moscow University. So together, me and him, we have to uncover very, very old treasure which hidden somewhere in Moscow. So, you know, every day we're looking for treasure, and every night we're street racing. And let me tell you, we crashed about 40 cars during the shoot. And
we spent
about $9 million making this film. All producers, they were very nervous when we opened it in Russia last year. But again, it was successful. It was successful in Russia, and also we sold it to 42 countries already. And in Eastern Europe, all around Eastern Europe, it was a theatrical film. And here, you know, it's straight to DVD, but still, you know, I'm very proud that my film is in every Blockbuster store, every Hollywood video store, on your homepage. And, you know, I like this film. I just hope American audience will enjoy it, because it's really a Russian answer to Hollywood films.
Exactly. And you've got other films in the pipeline too. You got you mentioned Hercules, which you're working on now, but you've also got something called Magic Man.
Yes. And Magic Man is on the final stage of post-production. And let me tell you, it was my first film which I produced completely in America, in Las Vegas. We shot it in Las Vegas, and I'm playing a Russian-American detective who works in Vegas for Las Vegas Police Department. And Billy Zane, great Billy Zane, you know, he plays Las Vegas magician, very famous magician like David Copperfield, and there is serial killing going on. And I have to figure out, and every killing staged is a magic trick or something like that. It's a magic show. So I have to figure out if Billy Zane's character a killer or not. And we have a lot of great guys there. We have Robert Davi, he's playing my partner. We have Armand Asante, who is playing Las Vegas police chief. And also we have Bai Ling. You know, she just did that film with Jason Statham.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you about Bai. You know, she's a great girl. First day on the set, you know, I came to her and asked her, "Hey, Bai, where are you from?" Because, you know, I'm trying to be friendly with everyone and everything.
Right.
And she told me, "I'm from the moon." And I asked her, "Okay, and where are your parents from?" And she said, "They're also from the moon." You know, it was last conversation we had.
She's a riot in Crank High Voltage. I mean, she's hilarious in that.
Absolutely, but she looks great on the screen. She's a great actress.
Oh yeah.
It was fun. It was fun, and we had a good director, Stuart Cooper. He won Berlin Film Festival twice. So this is a thriller. It's not much an action movie. It's a thriller with a horror element in that. So
right.
I hope you'll enjoy it too. It should be out. We will have theatrical premiere in Russia probably in October, and it should be out at least on DVD here in the U.S. closer to the New Year. New Year.
Yeah. Have you met your idol Schwarzenegger?
I did. I was introduced to Arnold by Ralph Müller. If you remember Conan TV show, Ralph, he's a big guy. He was a Mr. Universe. He was with Russell Crowe in Gladiator, big German guy.
Right.
He introduced me to Arnold in 2000. And I had the book, which was signed by Mr. Gorbachev, our ex-president, who I know personally. So before my visit to America, Mr. Gorbachev signed the book for Arnold. That was the reason for us to meet. I gave him a book, and I spoke to him. And he gave me a couple of advices, which I also used. He told me, you know, to learn English. He told me to learn acting.
Mm-hmm.
And later, I became a member of Grand Havana Room. It's a private cigar club here in Beverly Hills.
Right.
By the way, where are you located, guys? Where are you located?
That's complicated.
It is complicated.
I'm actually in Florida, and Jerry is in Maryland.
I'm in Maryland.
and I'm in Beverly Hills right now. So it's
wow. I'd like to be where you are.
So you're in the Havana Room, right? The Havana Room?
Absolutely. So just, you know what? Just let me know when you're here in L.A. Just let me know, and I'll be happy to take you to Grand Havana Room. We'll smoke cigars.
I can be there in about 5 hours.
Yeah, I can be there tonight, but not a worry in the world. I'd much rather be there. But
yeah, that's true. That's true. This is a terrific career you got going, and we both wish you the very best of luck.
Yeah, this has been a pleasure to talk to you. Really.
I got one more question for you. Just one quick question. I'm a weakling. How do I get in shape?
You know what? You know what we should do? We should do like some because it's not the first time I approached by geek in a good sense. You know? we should do something like muscles for geeks. That's what we should do. Because,
I'm all for that, man. I'm
definitely
all for that.
Because, and let me tell you, when I was a kid, I was a geek, right? And I didn't do any sports until I was like 15 years old. And all these, you know, big guys, you know, trying to pick on me. They never read any comic books or they never watched any movies. They just, you know, they just did some sports. So when I became successful in Russia, in all my TV shows, and all my, you know, books and articles, I was trying to promote bodybuilding exactly, you know, first of all, for geeks, for guys, you know, who read books, who read comic books, who are intelligent, but also who can, you know, gain some muscles. So to answer your question short, it's just, you know, if you have time, just go to the gym like three times a week. And do some basic exercises like bench press or squats. Just do it, you know, just do it regularly, at least 3 times a week. And try to eat more, because that's important thing, because we all have millions of things to do every day, right? So
right.
To eat like 3 or 4 times a day, it's tricky. But if you want to get bigger, first you have to eat, and second you have to be in the gym at least, you know, three times a day. And you know what else you should do? You should call me or write me directly. You know, and in all geeks who listen us right now, they can send me an email. It's info@hollywoodstorm.com. info@hollywoodstorm.com. They can send me their questions about muscles. I'll be happy to answer it. Because I think we geeks, we have to be bigger, right, and more muscular.
That's right.
I'm tired of being the geek that everybody beats up on.
I don't think anyone beats up on you, James.
Not as far
as I know.
Okay, I will give you progress reports, my friend. I'm going to get in the gym. I'm inspired by you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all your support, guys.
No problem. Thank you for being on. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Alexander.
Very much, guys. Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Okay, Alexander Nevsky. The film is Treasure Raiders. You can purchase it on our homepage. It's out now on DVD. Great guy.
He was a trip. I thought you'd go to the gym anyways. I mean, I thought you were like, you know, totally buff and all that. I always thought you went.
I'm totally buff.
Yeah.
Right. you flatter me, Jerry.
Well, you know, I'm there. You know, I go. You know, I'm according to him, I'm doing the right thing. I'm there like
you
like,
are.
So I'm doing the right thing. I'm doing one thing right in my life, so that's good. Okay.
Every time I call you, you're walking. You're in the gym.
Yeah, I know.
You know.
I'm always, you know, I'm causing trouble though. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I go through periods where I'm inspired to, hey, I'll work out, and I get into it for a while. It's a commitment, though. You know, you gotta stick to it. You gotta have stick-to-itiveness, and I lack that.
What did you
say?
Like, stick-to-itiveness?
Stick-to-itiveness.
I like that. That's good. I like that. That's very good. All right.
Yeah. It's my word. Yeah, anyway, great show tonight. We appreciate everyone's involvement, all of our great guests, all of our listeners in the chat room, and everyone listening on replay. You guys are awesome. Check out Treasure Raiders. Check out Jennifer Lynch's Surveillance.
Check out Hollywood Dreams and everything
Irene
else.
In Time, yeah. Check out the remainder of our Ronnie Cox interview later on this month when we do our Hal Ashby tribute. And check us out this Wednesday where we'll be paying tribute to the Pacino De Niro classic Heat. Great movie. I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome film. Just awesome film.
Thank you, Jerry, so much, man.
Thank you. And have a good night, everyone.
Talk to you guys later.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.